This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joy podcast from LGBTQIA+ community radio station, Joy 94.9. For more information and tons of other podcasts, head to joy.org.au.
Our next guest in the studio.
Yes. Sitting with us, we have Dr. Jane Eckert, who's here to talk to us about Centre 5 as the curator of a new exhibition at the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery. Thanks for joining us, Jane.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Pleasure. So, Jane, I warned you before you came in. We usually do a little bit of a background on who we're talking to so our listeners have a bit of scope. What can you tell us about your entry into the art scene and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So I'm an art historian, which I don't know if they come on very often into this program. I know you normally speak to artists and curators.
Yeah,
we occasionally have the art historian. So I studied at the University of Queensland and University of Sydney. Came out as a fully fledged art historian, put that on my passport application and thought, ooh, I don't even know what one is, but I am an art historian now. Went off overseas and I worked in art auctions in Ireland for 8 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How was that? What experience did you have there? You know, Ireland, yeah. you don't expect it, but Ireland went through a renaissance, didn't it?
That's
about
right.
20 years ago.
Well, I was there at the height of what they call the Celtic Tiger economic boom. So there was lots of cash floating around being spent on art. It was pretty exciting.
A lot of Europeans were moving there, weren't they?
Yep. There was a very mobile population, but still quite a small country. So you got to very quickly know, it felt like every single person in Ireland, and we all drank in the same bars and it was a very social scene. It was fun, a lot of fun.
And what about the art that you were dealing with there? You know, like, where was it from? Was it Irish art?
It was all Irish and a bit of British.
Right.
So I had to it was a deep dive when I arrived and had to very rapidly brush up on my Irish art history, which, funnily enough, had never been taught in Australia. And whilst I was there, I was asked to do all sorts of funny things, but one job I was asked to do whilst working full-time in the auction house was to teach a night course at University College Dublin on the history of European sculpture from the 18th century to the present day, which was an enormous subject.
Yeah.
And again, it was a deep dive. I had no background in the topic. So it was a 12-week seminar course.
And what did you cover? You know, give us an example.
Sort of neoclassical sculpture, like, you know, Canova, Antonio Canova, and then, you know, right up to sort of installation art. You know, we went right up until the present day. The final week was on contemporary Irish sculpture.
Right.
But it was really as a result of sort of preparing that 12-week course that I thought, I really want to do a bit more work on this and I wanted to come back to Australia. So I spent about a year reading up on Australian sculpture while still in Ireland and realised that there was this group, Centre 5, who were really interesting, whose origins were sort of European, and I wanted to sink my sort of teeth, as it were, into a subject that was not entirely Australian. I didn't want to sort of pigeonhole myself as an Australian art historian. And because they had these really strong European connections.
Yeah, well, they would have because of the era, wasn't it? Because it's more 50s, 60s, isn't
it? Yeah. Exactly. So nearly all of them actually studied in Europe before World War II or during the war. That was the real opening. And there was one essay that had been written in 1970 by Professor Margaret Plant on Centre 5, and that was pretty much it. Then there were books on each of the seven individual sculptors in the group.
Yep.
There was quite a lot done on them as individuals, but not as a group.
Right. Yeah. But what does it mean? You know, like Centre 5, what does it mean?
So Centre 5 was the name that these seven sculptors chose to exhibit together under, and it related to the fact that they had a five-point program of aims of what they wanted to achieve as a group.
Yep.
So it wasn't the number of sculptors
because
in the group.
I thought it was to begin with, and then all of a sudden you start looking and go, hold on, there's seven sculptors. Few more.
Well, ironically, the man who was responsible for bringing the group together, a Hungarian emigre by the name of Julius Kane. Sadly, he took his own life only about 6 months after forming the group. So then they were down to six. And then the youngest member of the group, Norma Redpath, who was Melbourne-born, was increasingly occupied with these major commissions that saw her working in a studio in Milan for most of the year round.
Whoa.
So she actually withdrew from the group in mid-1964. So she was really only with them for 2 years as well.
Right.
2.5 years. So then they were down to five. So the Centre Five did ironically end up with five members, right, but they began with seven.
And what were the five points, just briefly?
Yeah, so the first point was to what they called bridge the gap between art and life. And by that, that's a really sort of avant-garde call. You know, they were very consciously echoing pre-World War One avant-gardes that wanted to sort of eradicate that that real lack of communication between artist and public, okay? So to bridge the gap between art and life. And they wanted to do that through not just exhibitions, but through, you know, education, through public lectures, through interviews on the radio, in the newspaper, on television. Now, I should have actually memorized their 5 points. So they also wanted to see state institutions, state museums really exhibiting contemporary Australian sculpture. They wanted more scholarships available for young sculpture students and more prizes available for sculptors, because a lot of the big prizes, you know, you think such as the Archibald, for instance, at that point, at 1960, they were really all dedicated to painters. There weren't many opportunities for sculptors. Even, you know, the Blake Prize for Religious Art, it started, I think, in 51, was originally only for painters. And the sculptors really had to push to say, hey, we can produce religious art too, you know, can we please enter the exhibition, you know, your prize? So it was always a bit of an uphill battle for the sculptors. And I think their fifth and final point was to see a percent for art scheme implemented. So major public building programs, projects should have a percentage put aside for public commissions.
Right, okay, for the courtyard area at the front.
Or any sort of art that could be integrated with the building.
Yep.
The sculptors were also very aware that their skills are so closely allied with the skills of architects.
Yep.
And that they can work in collaboration with architects, and they can come up with sort of creative solutions to architectural problems. So they really wanted architects to work more closely with them.
And did it work? You know, like, you know, they're names that we know a lot, and they're still around.
Yep.
So it obviously did. But, you know, like, how much impact did they have?
Yeah, it's there's no simple yes or no did it work answer. I would argue that, yes, it worked, and then there's some caveats. So for each of those seven sculptors, it was a struggle for each of them to really achieve sufficient commissions to, you know, put food on the table.
Yep.
Nevertheless, they laid the groundwork, as it were, for a later generation. So insisting on things like contracts that were drawn up with the artist's interests in mind, and that would stipulate when payment would be made, and not expect the sculptors to pay for the whole thing out of their pocket then be reimbursed a year later.
And transporting.
Exactly. Reading through the sculptors' diaries, it's interesting following all those details of the trouble. So an architect might approach them and say, oh, would you like to design this for this project? The sculptor might, you know, agree verbally and be asked, can you show me what you have in mind? So they have to then produce a maquette, a little working model, or at very least some working drawings, all of which take their time and effort.
Mm.
And sometimes they weren't paid for those. Sometimes they were, but it was always a scrabble to try and
be
reimbursed for their troubles. In certain circumstances, it might be a case of over 3 years of negotiations with the client and the architect and all the models that they've produced. And at the end, the client changes their mind and the whole project's called off. Those kind of frustrations.
But that's unfortunately the the world of an artist, though, isn't it? And especially a sculptor, because it is a tough world, isn't it?
Yes, it was tough then, and it is still tough.
Still tough, yeah.
I suppose I would say they were successful, Centre Five, in that they highlighted all of those issues that they faced, and they were part of a broad shift to saying, actually, we need to formalise this process and have a contract that outlines what's expected of all parties, and not just expect the artist to produce pro bono continually. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, did some of them make money?
A little bit. That's an interesting question. So Clifford Last remained on his own all his life, so he didn't have a family to support. And when he died, he left his entire estate to the Lucius Trust in London, which was a sort of religious group or spiritual group. He was subscribed to all of their literature and, you know, as they espouse like daily meditation and vegetarianism, for instance. So I think because he was on his own largely, he was able to do all right. Those who were supporting families found it a little bit more of a struggle. They all had to teach, and that was the main issue, that, you know, sometimes the teaching would take over from their own private studio time or their ability to do commissions. So teaching was really how most of them kept their head above water.
And also the fact is that, you know, like you have to have a warehouse. You know, so it's not just, you know, painting in your bedroom or a back room. You have to pay for a space to work.
Yeah, only one of the seven actually had that warehouse space, and that was Vincas Yamantis from Lithuania. And he shared a studio down in Cheltenham with Leonard French, the painter.
Ah, okay.
And it's interesting because quite independently their work is obviously both about sort of symbolic abstraction, and they were both already working that way before they palled up and shared this studio space. But the others all worked primarily from home, had home studios. They're certainly very far from a warehouse. They would all have a studio in the backyard, not much larger than your average garden shed, really.
Yeah.
Inga King lived with her husband, was Graham King, the painter printmaker. Their whole house in Warrandyte was designed around their studios.
Wow.
That was sort of an integral part of their living and working space.
So what can we expect when we go to see this exhibition, and where is it?
All right, so the exhibition,
is it outside, inside?
So the exhibition is actually across the entire space of McClelland, so it occupies all of the gallery, interior gallery spaces, but it also takes in the fact that a lot of the works permanently sited in the sculpture park at McClelland, and for those of your listeners who don't know, McClelland is in Langwarrin, just outside Frankston. Yep. So a lot of the permanent works are actually also by Centre Five members. So from the gallery desk, you can pick up a little walking trail that highlights which works are by Centre Five and which works are from the period, because all of the sculptors, you know, were active over a long period.
Yep.
So the exhibition really focuses on just the decade when they were most active. So from 1962, when they first formed, January 62, through to 1973. And in 73, there was their sort of final hurrah, an exhibition as a group that was held at both Geelong Gallery and then moved to McClelland. So sort of appropriately enough, their last exhibition was at McClelland.
There. Right. Still alive, any?
No, sadly. So when I first started studying the group in 2009, the only remaining members were Inga King, the Berliner, and Norma Redpath. So I was very, very fortunate to work with both of them and have full access to their studios. And the others I've had to rely on the memories of their family members, and most of them recorded interviews over the years. I think the only sculptor I never heard an interview with was Julius Kane, who sadly, as I said, died in 1962. Nevertheless, in the process of the PhD, I did come across a very rare interview he gave in Canada in 1961 with a man who later became a very famous historian in Canada, but who was then just a student reporter for the student newspaper at the Toronto College of the Arts. And Ontario College of Arts. So, so I managed to get bits and pieces to hear their voices, as it were, and drew on lots of different archives.
Yeah.
So the Centre 5 archive is held at the National Gallery of Victoria in their research library. That in itself took over a year to locate. It was missing. I knew it had been donated because Inga was wringing her hands saying, oh, I gave it to the NGV. They should have it. It turned up eventually underneath a curator's desk.
Whoa.
His name shall remain unnamed, but he was very apologetic. Anyway, so that was terrific. So we got it properly accessioned and catalogued and it's been terrifically useful for this exhibition. In fact, we've got a number of items from the archive in the exhibition.
Okay.
And then the sculptor's individual archives. So some of them are in public collections, some are still in private hands.
And have you done a catalogue?
Yes, there is an extensive catalogue. It was interesting writing the catalogue because it was my first opportunity, I suppose, to really write about the activities of Centre 5 because the PhD I did at the University of Melbourne was a prehistory of the group that looked at the origins of their philosophy as sculptors, whereas this exhibition really allowed me to finally present in quite, dare I say, forensic detail all of their activities, drawing on that archival material. So,
brilliant.
Yeah, and we've got, the exhibition itself, in terms of, to go back to your earlier question, what to expect, as well as the actual works from the 60s and some earlier pieces from the 50s in the case of Julius Kane and Tesuta Sicarus, where they were both probably more active in the 50s than in the 60s. We've also got photographs, black and white photos of examples of collaboration with architects, and a lot of those works would be still well known to your listeners today, perhaps the best known being Inga King's Forward Surge on the Arts Centre lawn outside the Melbourne Arts Centre.
I've always loved that.
Fabulous.
So fabulous.
It is fantastic. Yeah. I think Richard Serra, eat your heart out when I see that, when I see the skateboarders go up. She used to love the skateboarders using that piece, by the way.
And so, I also loved it that during the Commonwealth Games, the last time they were here, because they created that as a beach scene so that people could go at lunchtime and take their shoes and socks off and they painted them blue because they were waves and she went, it.
She was, her whole philosophy was that sculpture should be part of the community and to be used and, if it gives people a smile to paint it blue, then paint it blue. Mm. There's another big piece at Melbourne University called Sun Rings, and at one point the students wrapped it in aluminium foil. She thought that was hilarious. And funny enough, that sort of predated by about 30 years her final series of work, the Celestial Rings, which were in polished stainless steel, brushed stainless steel, and they were sort of interlocking rings relating to her ideas about the constellations and the skies. And so, funnily enough, her sun ribbon, when it was wrapped in foil, actually almost preempted that by a few decades.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in and explain, and thank you for putting this exhibition together. Fantastic. Can't wait to see it. Where's it on again?
So it's on at McClelland Gallery, Langwarrin. So just under an hour's drive from Melbourne. And, it's well worth making the day trip down there. The sculpture park itself is stunning.
It's a beautiful walk. Beautiful walk around.
Fabulous cafe. You can make a day trip of it. It's just a lovely spot to come and visit. And, it's a rare opportunity to see these works together. The last time there was any Centre 5 show was in 1984.
Whoa.
I was a child. So there you go. It's, these things don't happen very often that you get these good historic shows pulled together.
Brilliant. Thank you. And it runs until?
Till March 3rd. 5th.
Right. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We've been talking to Dr. Jane Eckert here on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community radio station, Joy 94.9. For more podcasts or to support Joy by becoming a member, donating or subscribing, head to joy.org.au. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.